Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation will be with Tracy Wilkinson, a crisis intervention specialist with Scottsdale Police Department. And we're going to be discussing law enforcement, emergency situations, and dementia. You know, Janice, this is something that we hope that we'll never have to encounter if we're caring for someone who's living with dementia, interacting with law enforcement. But I've worked a lot with Tracy over the years in our crisis intervention training program, which really teaches people how to recognize the verbal and the behavioral messages delivered by someone with dementia and identify strategies to help connect and communicate with them. And what I found so interesting in this training is, you know, it's all about different types of mental illnesses and the way that law enforcement and first responders are trained to interact with these other types of illnesses is different and oftentimes can counteract how we want people or encourage people to respond to people with dementia. So it's, I think it's a really key component of that training. But again, emergency situations are something that we hope to avoid, but it's comforting to know that we have individuals who are specialized in interacting with people with dementia.
That is so comforting. And it's so good to know that there are people like Tracy out there that are providing this type of training to our police officers and our first responders. And as far as care partners and families, there are just so many ways that we're encouraged to plan for emergencies, everything from when we were children to fire drills, for me growing up in Kansas to tornado drills to now just having emergency phone numbers in our smartphones to having extra water and food on hand. So when it comes to the dementia journey, I am really looking forward to finding out from Tracy what the most important things that caregivers can do to be prepared in advance.
Welcome, Tracy. Thank you for joining our conversation.
Hello, Heather and Janice. It's so good to be with you today.
So, Tracy, I want to learn a little bit more about you before we dive into this conversation. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey and what led you to connect with the dementia community?
I'm employed with the Scottsdale Police Department in a unique role as a behavioral and mental health professional and have responded several times to residents where an individual is impacted by dementia, Alzheimer's disease, and work to support their family as officers respond. What really began my journey with learning more and providing services to individuals is about in 2014, the East Valley CIT program collaboration was created. And we were developing curriculum to provide to our officers and other first responders. And we really looked at, were we serving the dementia community enough? We wanted to provide training, certainly our communities in Scottsdale, Mesa, Chandler, Gilbert. Some of us have a population of individuals, the senior population, and therefore a greater likelihood that officers would interact with individuals. And in developing that curriculum, I came to introduce myself to you, Heather, and our journey together began. So that was part of my interest in dementia. And then a few years ago, my younger sister developed frontal temporal lobe dementia and ALS, and that then made it very personal for me.
Thank you for sharing that story, Tracy. And it's been so impactful to work for you. I've gained such insight into what law enforcement and first responders face on a daily basis and the complexities of the situations that they're brought into, you know, really training with law enforcement first and foremost is to protect self, but things like mental illness and mental health and dementia require a very different skill set. Can you talk a little bit about how first responders would differentiate in these situations?
Part of something that I feel certainly very passionate about is our crisis intervention team training. And that gives officers specific skill sets and knowledge about working with individuals who are presenting with a mental illness, an intellectual or developmental disability, and dementia. And how they speak with someone, we talk about how they might talk much slower with individuals who are experiencing symptoms of dementia, to ask some simple questions, limit the reality checks, to keep eye contact. So give them some of those specific skills to provide a better intervention and to de-escalate that situation.
Tracy, just listening to your voice, I can see how you could come into a situation and just hearing you, you could de-escalate a situation. And when you go into those type of situations, what do you see as some of the biggest needs of these families that are living with dementia that you're getting called on for support?
So often I find these families are very isolated, whether it be concerned about their partner's behaviors in public. Sometimes it's just simply not having the resources, having the knowledge. They may be living out here in their community without friends and family. And so sometimes just that support, knowing that they are not alone and giving them resources for this long journey is a way to best support them.
I'd like to maybe run by some specific scenarios where law enforcement may be called in for a person living with dementia. And one of the first ones that comes to mind for me is wandering. And I know at some point in time, 2/3 of people with dementia will wander through the course of their disease. And I always find it's really hard working with families because they say, well, my person doesn't wander, so it's not something that I need to worry about. But of course, they don't wander until they do. So can you talk to us a little bit more about that?
And it may not even be purposeful wandering. Perhaps it's just their thought that I'm going to go to the grocery store. And then they become lost and don't know how to get back. And maybe don't even remember that that was their intention, was to go to the grocery store. I think it happens perhaps more frequently than we even identify. Recently, we had an individual that was knocking on someone's door, actually trying to make entry, and they were just mistaken. That was not their residence. That's not where they resided anymore. One of the tools that I would suggest for family members, knowing that that wandering may occur, is to keep a current photo of their loved one or the person that they're providing care for. Because when they do wander, then they can say to the police department, here's what my person looks like. Maybe here's what they were even wearing today. Heather, you and I have discussed before, perhaps taking a selfie each day. Let's send it to the grandkids. Let's send it to our daughter. And therefore, it's a lot easier to remember in that time of emergency, oh my goodness, this is what they were wearing today, and be able to provide that information to our public safety personnel.
And I know with wandering, for families, there's often a lot of guilt that comes with it, you know, but it's so easy for that person to just slip away. You look away for a second and out the door they go. What do you encourage for families when reaching out to law enforcement?
As much as you can, prepare ahead of time. Having that photo of the individual, having, for instance, knowing what your car license plate number is, the make and model of your vehicle. If the individual likes to take the dog for a walk and they usually go by this park, having all that information ahead of time so that officers, when they start looking, have that information. And I think you're very right, Heather. It's so often for families to kind of wrap their head around that my loved one may be getting lost and doesn't understand the need to even ask for directions. Or if a community member gives them directions, they may not understand past step two or step three. And that's hard for us when we really love someone to have that understanding that they may not be as they once were.
It is so difficult to understand that. And I love how the community is coming together to support these families and individuals. And one of the ways that I hear about this support is sometimes on the news, we will hear of a silver alert and how the community can be watching for someone. Can you tell us about silver alerts?
Silver alerts can be a great tool for our community and for public safety personnel when someone is missing. Currently in Arizona, we have 11 active silver alerts. I remember just going down the freeway last week, and it seemed every single day I would see another one across the highway, and it was a different individual each time. There are certain criteria that public safety or law enforcement has to have in order to provide that silver alert. And part of that is initially going through all of the, have they looked everywhere? Have they made the notifications? Have they checked hospitals? All those sorts of criteria ahead of time. But the Silver Alerts, it's a national program, and it's for individuals with Alzheimer's disease, dementia, someone who is 65 years of age or older. And it also now includes individuals with a developmental disability or autism.
Tracy, I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about another, situation that could potentially have tragic repercussions even, but one that's often met with resistance, which is firearms. You know, I know at Banner Alzheimer's Institute, as soon as someone receives a diagnosis, we begin encouraging families to remove the firearm from the home, regardless of if this person has been a responsible gun owner their entire lives, because it can pose some complications to that. Can you discuss that with us?
Certainly. Some of the statistics that I've reviewed recently show that firearms may be present in 2/3 of the residents when someone has been diagnosed with one of the dementias. So certainly a large predominance. I think oftentimes families may say, oh, let's just take all the ammunition away, lock it in a different closet. However, when public safety responds, we aren't going to know that that firearm is not loaded. And it may very well be that an individual presents to public safety with that firearm because they believe that there's invaders into the residence. There's someone in their backyard, or they do not recognize that person in their residence. That's not my husband. I have a new caretaker this week, and that's not the one I'm used to having. And it can be very scary. There was a former or retired police chief who had years and years of experience with firearms, and he ended up shooting his wife, perhaps inadvertently. It takes a skill set to be able to manage firearms, the intricacies, and sometimes those skills aren't present anymore. And the best option is to remove them, have those discussions with the family ahead of time. Is there someone that we might provide this firearm to? Our son, let him have it. Give it to a museum, for instance, if it is a collector's piece. The Alzheimer's Association has a very good firearm safety handout for individuals. That's certainly a resource, and I would encourage families to have those discussions about firearms before it becomes an emergency.
Yes, thank you for sharing about that and about the importance of removing those firearms and that tragic story. And you mentioned that sometimes people living with dementia will think that there are invaders in the residence, or saying things like, "That's not my husband."
Police frequently get called to those types of scenarios where they might mistake that tree branch that's hitting against the window as someone trying to break in, or that wedding ring has been stolen and they've maybe put it in some place that they don't recall because it's special and they want to keep it hidden so that someone doesn't come and take it. So that's part of the frequency that we get with law enforcement. And sadly, also those times too, when literally the individual doesn't recognize their family members. And one of the tools that we ask officers to utilize is to ask that individual when they respond, "How old are you?" And that will give the officers some insight. If the individual is saying, "I'm 35 years old," then that gentleman sitting across the way, he has the same name as my husband. He's telling me things, but that's not my husband. Or for instance, when the resident is saying, "You know, I'm waiting for my children to come home from school," and they're 80 years old and no longer have those children coming home from school. That's a tool that we suggest that officers utilize so that they can better understand where the individual is coming from and provide a better intervention that way.
I think that's a really difficult tool that we encourage families to use as well, as not doing that reality orientation. And I know that's a big step away from a lot of the training that first responders use as well, is really stepping into that person's world to get a better understanding of where they're coming from, what their perspective is in that moment. Do you have some other just general kind of home safety strategies that you could share with our listeners?
I think one thing is to have a plan when you call 911, that first thing you want to do is to provide your name and your address. A lot of times individuals are using cell phones and they don't give us that direct address as a landline might. When you're calling the 911, talk about the nature of your call, why it is that you need police. If you're calling because your family member has perhaps become violent, you want to talk about what that violence looks like. Sometimes in our crisis, we may want to sort of exaggerate it. Hurry up, let's get the police here. Hurry, hurry, hurry. And say they have a knife, when in fact they may not, or they may not have made those actual threats. So we want to be truthful when you make that call to 911. You want to talk if there are any weapons in the house, any firearms, so that officers know that ahead of time. If you have a family member in crisis, talk about what they're wearing, the height and weight. Because so oftentimes when officers might respond to that crisis, we may not always know who it is that's calling and who's the individual that is seeking help. As officers present to that resident, somebody comes out running at them. We don't really know, is that the individual in crisis? Is that our reporting party? And what exactly does that look like?
Thank you for sharing these really great tips about how to share information in advance and about these safety strategies. And one of the things that comes to my mind when we talk about safety is driving. I'd like you to just share a little bit about a law enforcement perspective on driving.
When you think about driving down the road, you're looking at perhaps three mirrors. You've got turn signals. You are driving something that weighs thousands of pounds. It takes a lot of skill to do that. And oftentimes, individuals with dementia and Alzheimer's may not have those skills anymore. And we have to really look at having that conversation with our loved ones. When is it perhaps time to retire and no longer drive? There have been just tragic stories of individuals who have again, going to the grocery store. Maybe they were going to their dental appointment and they start driving and become disoriented. Oftentimes, individuals may drive until literally they run out of gas. And we find them having pulled off the side of the road. Maybe they are then getting out of the car to seek help and fall because they've driven off the roadway and it's not a good place for them to be. So as difficult as it is, those discussions have to be had. There's a lot of resources out there about how to have those discussions and to really start making those changes. Sometimes it's easier for a family member or a care provider to ask their physician to submit a retest to the motor vehicles division for their loved one, as opposed to having that conversation directly. And that might be a good resource for someone to have that retest and the individual, when the state says you can no longer drive, that might be a bit easier than myself as a loved one saying you don't have that capability to drive anymore.
There's such complexity that goes into driving. You know, it's our source of freedom. We go where we want to go when we want to go there. And a lot of times in couples, maybe only there was only one driver in the couple. And now that person develops dementia and the spouse thinks, well, I'll just help them navigate. Or you have someone who just is really tied to still driving their car and you disable the vehicle or you take it away. And people with dementia, when they're determined to do something, will find a way to do it. And you shared a story of a gentleman who actually went out and rented a car.
Right. His family members had taken the vehicle away or perhaps was involved in a collision, and he got in a rental vehicle and literally was found as he crossed the border into Mexico, and there was a silver alert. So it can be very frightening. And it's so true, Heather. It's not always easy to use public transportation. Maybe one individual is the one who has driven for all those years in that partnership. But there is such a risk to not only themselves, but to the other individuals on the roadway, and just the complexities of left turn here, go another mile, right turn. It can be more than an individual can handle and be a very stressful situation as well.
It just sounds so stressful. And I can only imagine how stressful that would be for families. And I'm so glad there are resources out there like the ones that you mentioned. And when it comes to resources and tools that are available, I want to shift gears and just ask you how people can prepare in advance for emergencies. What are some of the tools that are available?
Most public safety agencies will take some information from you. For instance, if you wanted to notify them that there is an individual in your household that maybe uses hearing aids and doesn't always wear them, maybe they have a vision problem. In this instance, maybe I have a loved one with dementia who is experiencing some cognitive and memory issues. You can register, for instance, through Smart 911. There are national programs such as the Special Needs Alert Program, which allows individuals to provide some information up front to public safety agencies. There's Return Me Home. There's the Residence Assistance Program, Smart Alert Program. Reach out to your public safety agency and find out about those registration programs. There's also the medical alert program. Many law enforcement agencies allow individuals with dementia or Alzheimer's to be able to register for free. And while sometimes an individual may not want that medical alert bracelet, maybe there is a bracelet that they can use that, for instance, I have a friend that's a runner and she wants to have that emergency contact with her at all times. So she has a little bracelet that says, in case of emergency, contact this individual. And perhaps the easy way to do it, or a way to make it not so difficult to have that conversation, if both individuals in the family, for instance, the husband and wife, if they both register, if they both have those in case of an emergency, contact this person. That might be an easier way to make it a little bit more palatable.
These are all great resources, Tracy. A lot of our conversation today has focused on when the person with dementia is having an emergency. I wonder, from the public safety perspective, what happens when a caregiver has an emergency, and can we plan in advance for that?
Please develop that crisis plan ahead of time. There are occasions when that care provider has a medical emergency. They are taken to the hospital, and then we have the individual who is needing care, and we're kind of at a loss. Who do we contact? So whether you have family members, whether somebody is receiving in-home assistance from a particular agency, if you have that all information handy. Sometimes people put that information on their refrigerator as a place that public safety may look to find that information. Here's family members, here's the care provider, so that we have that information going in. Sadly, there are times where that other individual may have to be transported to the hospital when there's not really a medical need. If we have to make a report to Adult Protective Services because that individual cannot provide care for themselves, Adult Protective Services may not respond in a timely manner. So please have that crisis plan developed ahead of time. And you may even, as part of those registry programs, have that information included.
Tracy, this has been such an important conversation, an enlightening conversation, and you've provided our listeners with some really actionable steps and great tools. I wonder if, before we close, you could provide us with your final thoughts when it comes to emergency situations, public safety, and dementia.
Plan for that emergency. I really liked when you talked, Janice, at the beginning today about planning for tornadoes, planning for the fire drills when we were all kids in school. So do that same sort of thing. Have those emergency contacts, have that information about your vehicle, should your family member, the person you provide care to, have gone to the grocery store and now it's hours later and they haven't returned. Have those recent photographs, have the information about emergency contacts, get those firearms secured away from the residence, plan what you need to say to 911, be prepared.
Today, our conversation has been with Tracy Wilkinson, a crisis intervention specialist with Scottsdale Police Department. We so appreciate you helping us untangle public safety and dementia.
It's been my pleasure today. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Tracy, for joining us today. And thank you for your work. And Heather, thank you also for your work in this area. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. If you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast. I'm looking forward to our next conversation on Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at banneralz.org and follow us on Facebook to learn about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.